Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. Good morning, Justice Moore. How are you today?
Good morning,
sir?
Rich. Good. Great to see you and Jeff here.
Great to see you as well.
Monday morning.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it's right off. You don't get a lot of time off for the holidays and stuff. I mean, you're just right off to the races at the first of the year, aren't you?
Yeah, we get an extra day in January that without arguments. They kind of built in one day. But yeah, I think, you know, this Supreme Court, I think, was the second week of January. And we just do typically start right after the holiday, like, you know, the Carleton does with the students coming back in the high school. And
yeah.
So, yeah, we dove back into it in January. We're through the January sitting. You know, generally the first 2 weeks are focused on oral arguments and then special term in our court meeting. And then the last 2 weeks of the month are focused on trying to get ready for the next month and working on opinions that are outstanding.
All right.
We're kind of in that latter stage right now.
Gotcha. Yeah. So what's been going on with the court this, what did you guys get to talk about or get to listen to at least?
Well, January's, cases were, pretty much consistent diet of similar types of things that we've had. I mean, there wasn't anything that was maybe necessarily state front page headline getting, but important cases to parties. We had cases in tax law, workers' comp law, criminal law, of course, and in some civil matters. I guess probably the biggest announcements in January were the impending retirements of two of our members, one of whom, Justice G. Barry Anderson, he's going on 70, and so under state law, he was going to be through in October of 24 when he hit 70, no matter what.
Yeah.
But he's announced his retirement effective May 10th, so that's going to be coming up fast, frankly.
Yeah,
and
it is.
The other justice that announced her retirement is Justice Margaret Chudich, who would have been on the ballot. Both Anderson and Chudich would have technically been on the ballots this fall if they had chosen to run, although Anderson couldn't have served. Chudich will leave at the end of the court term on July 31st, and so that will enable a new justice to get on board at a similar time when I did, when I started. So you start in August, and then the court session actually starts in September, and so that's when we start hearing cases. So
time to find your feet.
Yeah, we'll have two new members. And that'll be a big change. I mean, that'll be three new justices in a year.
Yeah.
After 3 years of my first 3 years of complete, you know, kind of quiet.
Yeah, you guys were rock solid for 3 years. Justice Anderson's, like you said, Justice Anderson's retirement was completely expected, and you and I have talked about that a little bit. But Justice Chudich, did you, as one of her colleagues, have any inkling that she was gonna retire?
Well, I've got to be careful here.
Okay.
get into private discussions.
I don't want to put you on the spot.
Yeah,
I apologize.
And I wouldn't want to be revealing anything. I think outside observers had noted that she had not done anything regarding an election campaign.
Sure.
And so I think that had piqued a few people's curiosity senses, the kind of the insiders, because she had a really tough election, it was an election in 2016 against Michelle McDonald, it was 2018, and against Michelle McDonald, and that was a tough one. That was not an easy campaign, and so you know, I'm not shocked, frankly. I mean, she's 65, 66 years old. She's been on the court. I was looking at numbers here. She started at about the same time I did, except she was appointed to the Court of Appeals in 2012 by Governor Dayton. So she will have completed a little over 12 years on either the Court of Appeals, where she was there till 2016, and then she came in 2016 to the Supreme Court. So, you know, she'll have about 12 years total, 8 years on the court. I mean, that's a not uncommon run, frankly. I think justices, I think we have three buckets of justices from what I've, the little I've looked at it in modern times. Mm-hmm. We get, we have people that end up getting appointed to the federal bench. I mean, yeah. we've had that happen a number of times. Justice Wright, Justice Erickson, Joan Lancaster Erickson, and Justice Strass, all appointed to federal court positions. And mm-hmm. so their tenures were shortened because of that. Mm-hmm. Then we have people who serve until mandatory retirement. You can serve until the last day of the month that you turn 70. So that was people like Justice Paul Anderson, Justice Ellen Page, mm-hmm. Chris Deedson. I think Justice Deedson was in that area or pretty close to it. And then you've got a number of justices that seem to go somewhere in that 6 to 8 year range. Mm-hmm. And I think it's frankly, Rich, just a reflection of the, you know, the intensity and seriousness of the work. I mean, you're really never off.
Right.
I mean, you're mentally kind of always on because there's always something brewing. There's always reading that could be done. There's always more work that could be done on opinions. It's really hard to find, you know, a stopping point. And, Justice Kudich's spouse had retired as CEO of Alina Health a year or so ago. So I think it's also that there's a family factor involved as well.
Wow, that's a power couple right there. My goodness.
Yeah, that's what they were described as. And the Star Tribune accurately is a power couple. I'm going to miss both.
Yeah. Yeah.
Both justices bring their own unique personality and mm-hmm. perspectives to the court. Justice Anderson was a product of Greater Minnesota. He was mm-hmm. born in Mankato, went to Mankato High School, started practicing in Fairmont and Martin County, and then after a short stint at a law firm in Fairmont, went to Hutchinson in McLeod County, and that's where he really kind of established his legal career and was a city attorney in Hutchinson and represented a lot of the governmental entities that are associated with the city of Hutch. And got appointed by Governor Carlson to the Court of Appeals mm-hmm. in 1998.
Okay.
And so he will have served 6 years on the Court of Appeals to October 2004, and then October 2004 to the present, about 19 years. So, you know, it'll be about a 25-year run for him.
And congratulations to him for that. That's pretty good.
That's great service. I mean, that's a long time to be a judge.
It is indeed.
It is. I've seen, you know, I don't know what the ideal tenure is for a judge. I know there's been some talk about 17-year terms for U.S. Supreme Court justices. I don't think that's gone anywhere. But, mm-hmm. Justice Anderson has gotten to the point in his career where he's done a lot of things mm-hmm. and richly deserves to, mm-hmm. you know, spend some more time with his family and do things that are interesting to him. I fully expect to see both Justices Anderson and Kudich continue to be engaged in the legal community. Mm-hmm. I think they'll both take some time to, you know, sort of digest the change in their lives, but I'm guessing we're going to see both of them back.
You said the same thing about Supreme Court or about the Chief Justice Gilday when she retired also.
Yeah, yeah. She is working at a Twin Cities Minneapolis law firm. She got hired as a partner in a law firm to consult on appeals, and Greenberg Traurig, I believe, is the firm.
Not a bad hire.
No. She would be a ideal person for that corner office. Yeah. Frankly, you couldn't have somebody that would be more scrutinizing of legal arguments, legal briefs, she's absolutely going to stay involved. So we're going to have a big transition, and when justices leave, they have to have all their work done before they walk out the door. I mean, Justice Anderson can't retire on May 10th and come back the next week and start working on finishing up opinions. I mean, it's
got
to
be done.
Everything that's assigned to him, all his separate writings, all have to be done. So at some point, he will be stopping assigning new cases. Same thing with Justice Kudich. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be a bit of a scramble come this spring to make sure everything's taken care of.
Does that put a little extra pressure on the rest of the court because you have to get everything done before before Justice Anderson's gone, before Justice Kudich is gone? Do you guys have to sort of speed up what you're doing too?
Yeah, everything has to be fast-tracked. I mean, a retiring justice's cases, in my opinion, should get priority mm-hmm. for review, separate writings, commissioner review. I mean, all the steps of our opinion process need to be accelerated when we've got a retiring justice coming, going. And since we're going to have two kind of at the same time, it's going to put a lot of pressure. And, you know, we're still hearing cases in May and June, too.
Yeah.
You know, June doesn't necessarily have to be a huge month. I mean, last year it was. Last year we had 2 weeks of arguments in June. Sometimes it's a one week argument month. But, yeah, I mean, neither of them will be hearing cases in June for sure. Anderson will be gone. Chudich probably may not be hearing cases in May. And so we may have a couple of months with some doubling up. So, yeah, it's going to put some pressure on the rest of the court. And it really, frankly, requires us to take advantage of February, because February is traditionally a bit of a lighter month.
It's,
we usually have 1 week of oral arguments, and so we have to get cracking on getting work done.
What does this mean for the clerks, the people who are assigned to Justice Anderson, for example, who are going to be working through July, I believe?
Yeah, they will.
So where does that leave them after Justice Anderson retires?
Well, they will continue. He's got an elbow clerk. He'll continue to work for the court. Justice Anderson and I share a shared clerk, so he'll continue working.
You get your own then. That's great.
Yeah, right. Maybe I get two clerks for the last couple months of this term. But trust me, we'll have plenty of work for everybody.
I don't doubt that.
But yeah, I mean, you know, the judicial assistant that works with Justice Anderson and the clerks will stay. Chudich will more or less walk out the door with her clerks this year. But then the people that we hired for next year, I mean, Justice Anderson's hired clerks for next year were already told that he wasn't going to be there for them. Chudich's clerks will have to be notified. But our tradition is that we retain everybody. I mean, I guess in theory, a new justice could come in and say, no, I want somebody different. But that in practice, that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And so everybody will have a job. It'll just be different, like it was this past fall when the chief justices switched. And so their clerks switched up things a little bit, which added. I've had five different clerks working on my cases this year, which is a little unusual because of the changing of the guard.
Right, right. Now, the process, I mean, we just went through this, but I think it's probably good to review the process every time we get a chance to talk about it. The governor will appoint people to sit in the seats of Justice Anderson and Justice Chudich. He does not have to have somebody ready to go the day that they both retire, right? I mean, he
doesn't, but in practice, I think he would like to. That's what he did with me. I mean, Justice Littlehog ended his term or his career on July 31st, 2020, and I was in the next Monday, August 3rd, I was sworn in ready to go. And if he follows that practice, Justice Anderson will end his tenure with the court on May 10th, which he'll be going out with a swearing-in ceremony from the February bar exam, which is kind of a nice way for him to cap his career.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next Monday will be, the 13th of May.
Yep.
And I would not be surprised to see a new colleague there. Now, does there have to be? No, but I think from a continuity standpoint, generally speaking, it's good to have a continuous occupant of a seat.
Well, especially since you're going to be hearing cases in May, or throughout May and into June, and throughout June, I guess, too. So,
well, at least part of it, yes. Yeah. I think, you know, the governor has to decide what process he's going to use to fill these positions.
Mm-hmm.
He does get the appointment authority. The justices appointed this year will be on the ballot in 2026.
Yep.
I mean, that's just the way it goes.
Yep.
Their positions will not be on the ballot this fall because of how state law works. So they get a little time to try to learn the job before they have to stand for election. We will have two other justices on the ballot this fall, Justice Ann McKeag and Chief Justice Hudson's positions will be on the ballot for the 2024 election. The governor has a variety of options. He could use the Judicial Selection Commission, which is what he did when I was appointed, or he could appoint internally without using the Judicial Selection Commission, which is what he did with Justice Procaccini, who was just appointed. I think it's very likely that a process will be announced similar to what my process was back in 2020, which is a panel consisting of members of the Judicial Selection Commission plus people from the governor's office.
Right.
To particularly with two vacancies here, I think that would be advisable. But, you know, it's the governor's prerogative for appointments, and then the voters will have an opportunity to have a say in 26.
You can't comment on this at all, but I would think just from a political standpoint, he would want to use the selection commission only because Justice Procaccini was a guy who had worked in his administration, and I think the governor probably would behoove him to look elsewhere, just maybe this once or twice. That's just my personal opinion. You, of course, Justice Moore, can't say a word about that.
Yeah, so. I probably shouldn't. This is the governor's prerogative, and
it wouldn't
be for me to tell him how to do things or what to do. I can only say that I think the court is benefited by the most open and transparent process possible that gives people the opportunity to indicate interest in the job. You know, they're big decisions for a governor. I mean, these are legacy appointments, and they need to be carefully considered. And I think the more advice you get, the more perspectives on that. And importantly, not just from people who are part of your inner sanctum, but, you know, from all aspects of the legal community.
Right.
I think that could be good. Yeah, we'll see. I'm very much of the belief that we're going to hear something soon about what that process is. And so by the time we come back in February, we will know, and it'll undoubtedly probably already be underway.
We talked about this a little bit the last time we went through this. I'm a little cloudy. Again, without naming names, just talking about the process, will you be asked your opinion on people who could fill the role?
I sure hope so. I was told that in 2020, the governor's office reached out to every member of the court regarding the person to replace Justice Little Hogg. And likewise, we were contacted regarding the Chief Justice position too, which was great. So I would expect that to continue. Yeah. I don't see any harm to that.
And no.
I think a lot of good. I mean, the institution of the court depends upon people being appointed who are reasonable, measured, and are collaborative, are going to be able to work with people.
Right.
And appointing folks who have, you know, particular political agendas or are, you know, kind of lone ranger types isn't going to help collaboration, and it's not going to help our court continue to be an institution that, that has public trust and confidence.
Something like that can really throw a monkey wrench into the whole system too for the court.
You can look at a number of state Supreme Courts that have had contested elections and divisive issues between members of the court, and we don't. I mean, obviously there's disagreements. You get that many people with, frankly, you know, that much legal acumen and egos into a room.
We would expect.
Yeah, there's going to be some bumping of heads occasionally. There's going to be some differences, but we do all back each other up regarding the institution, and Justice Anderson has demonstrated that too by giving the governor his appointment. You know, he technically could have just served out his term, and it could have been an open election for his seat if he had wanted to do that.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, his term actually ends technically. I mean, he has to retire on the last day of October, but technically his term doesn't expire until January of next year. And so 25. And so, you know, he could have, if he had wanted to, said, well, I'm just not going to file, and other people could file for my seat, and we'll see what happens. You know, that invites chaos.
Yes.
And that Justice Anderson is an institutionalist. He would never do that. And so he really showed that by giving the governor his appointment.
Right.
Yeah, so he'll go out on May 10th after we swear in the last group of attorneys under his tutelage. And one of the things Justice Anderson gets a lot of credit for is returning the lawyer admission ceremony, the big ceremonies, back to the Capitol.
Oh.
For years, they were done offsite, either at Roy Wilkins Auditorium or one of the O'Shaughnessy Auditoriums at St. Thomas or St. Kate's, kind of a, frankly, a cattle call, big, impersonal sort of thing. And under Justice Anderson's leadership, this was returned to the House chambers in October of the swearing-in ceremony, and then in the Supreme Court chambers in the spring, because there are fewer people there. Mm-hmm. And so that gives a chance for newly minted lawyers and their families to have a little bit more of a personal and impactful moment. And Anderson's leadership on the Board of Legal Examiners has been stellar. He's one of these behind the scenes people that gets a lot done. And he's been, you know, an ambassador to the court. He's one of the justices who predictably shows up at events when, you know, even events where the court isn't being, you know, recognized. Mm-hmm. And I think that tells us a lot about him, that he's there to recognize others. And he's been somewhat of an ambassador to outstate Minnesota, too, coming from, you know, McLeod County, which I guess I would consider to be outstate. So I will be, as of, you know, the 13th of May, the only justice currently on the court who was appointed from outstate Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, we talk about diversity, and I think geographic diversity on our appellate courts is really important.
Yep.
And that, if I'm given the opportunity to put my two cents in for these appointments, I will hope the governor will keep that in mind as
There are plenty of good candidates not working in the Twin Cities right now, I would think.
There are, and they just aren't as well known because of the, you know, the circles that the appellate bar travels in. It's a fairly tight-knit community, but there are a lot of very fine lawyers in greater Minnesota, some even in way outstate Minnesota, that, you know, deserve an opportunity. We'll see, you know, who applies there. We have traditionally seen members from the Court of Appeals elevated to the Supreme Court, some district court judges, and then occasionally we have people that have been more academic or corporate counsel or law firm related to get appointments as well. And those are all good opportunities here.
Well, I mean, I'm a guy who just loves the process, right? I anything happening in the American government, the way it all works to me is just a fascinating thing. I don't know if you can answer this. I don't know if you should answer this or not. Will people from the Judicial Commission reach out to certain judges and say, hey, you should apply to be on the Supreme Court? Is that how that works? Or?
If the Judicial Selection Commission is involved in the process, if they are involved, I think so. Okay. I mean, I can attest to that happening. I mean, you know, sometimes it takes people getting a nudge or a tap on the back and say, hey, you really should consider this, because, you know, for a lot of people, including me, to be very candid, the thought of applying for a Supreme Court clerk judgeship is a, you know, big, I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it requires a certain amount self-confidence to be willing to do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you don't have that inherently, having some people tell you, I think you've got what it takes, you should do this, is really important. Frankly, we do that for district court judgeships too. I mean, there are people who we think are potentially really good caliber lawyers that could be district court judges, and maybe they don't see it in themselves, or maybe they haven't thought about it, or maybe they come from communities where they assume, I'm never going to get chosen, so why bother?
Right.
And I think, you know, the outstate thing too, there is a bit of that feeling, you know, who gets appointed to the state Supreme Court from greater Minnesota? I mean, that's kind of the way I felt back in, you know, 2020. I mean, I applied for the Court of Appeals initially, and then the process has got expanded to include two positions at once. So there's a lot that goes on, Rich, and we'll just have to see. You know, obviously we are on the fourth floor of the Judicial Center, are all very, very interested in what happens.
Oh, but yeah.
We've got Justice Anderson around for a few months yet, and we got to get through our February, March, and April calendars, and then actually in May before Justice Anderson leaves, and then June for Justice Kudyk. So it'll be an eventful next 6 months. There's just no doubt about it.
So what's coming up in February then? What are you guys going to be hearing?
Well, it is a lighter month. We have, let's see, 2, 4, 6, 7 cases, so definitely a lighter month. 2 first degree murder direct appeals coming from, you know, convictions in district court. We have a workers' comp case, 4 PFRs. I think the most interesting PFR being petitions for review from Court of Appeals positions. The most interesting case for members or for listeners to consider would be on Thursday, the 8th of February. We are hearing Drake Snell versus Tim Walz, governor of the state of Minnesota. And that is a continuation of the effort to have Walz's emergency executive orders declared in violation of Minnesota law. They were based on the Minnesota Emergency Management Act back in 2020, when the governor declared a public health emergency. And it's procedurally complicated. The public health emergency was ended in the summer of 2021, kind of as part of a deal between the legislature and the governor's office. It had been extended from March of 2020 up until June of 2021 numerous times, 14, 15 different times, because under the law it could only last, I believe, 30 days at a crack. And it could only be canceled if both houses of the legislature agreed to do it. And, you know, because the Democrats, you know, were in control of at least one, that wasn't going to happen. Unlikely, at least. Well, the question is not moot because it could happen again. And so the parties have asked us to try to define, you know, under what circumstances does a public health emergency allow a governor to declare, you know, a natural disaster under Minnesota's emergency management law and issue, you know, orders of the type that were issued, including closing certain businesses, requiring people to wear masks in certain places, limiting occupancy, social distancing, all the things that are the memory of the 2021 years.
And we're all trying to forget.
And so here it's back. If you want to relive those, those years, listen
to that was fun.
Our argument on the 8th will be live streamed, and it will be something I think that will be very interesting to hear. Of course, what we know now and what we know then makes it a little challenging, you know, in terms of looking at, you know, what could have or should have been done differently. But so, you know, governors have a lot of power. And the question is, how is that power constrained within the ambit of the State Emergency Management Act? So that's the most interesting case in February, in my opinion.
I remember having a conversation. Now, this is about the United States Supreme Court with one of my poli-sci profs in when I was in college, and we were talking about Dred Scott. And because why not? I mean, this is what you talk about when you're a poli-sci kid. And I asked him flat out, do you think, I mean, could the Supreme Court have used that decision to just end slavery in the United States? And he just kind of looked at me and said, how long have you been studying this? The Supreme Court can pretty much do whatever it wants. So let me ask you, broadly, without trying to pin you down on anything, could you or could the state Supreme Court take this decision and completely rewrite the way the governor would be able to handle an emergency situation like this? I mean, you guys have the power to completely do that, or you could just make very specific changes, can't you? Or nothing.
Well, we have the power to say what the law means. I mean, we don't have the power to write law and to substitute words within a statute. We interpret the law. Instead, that's what statutory interpretation is, which this case will involve. And we do have the obligation to say what the law means. Now, that could be done broadly. It can be done narrowly. There are different ways to handle things. I think, you know, the rewriting of the statute won't occur. I mean, that's up to the legislature. If we find problems with how the governor exercised his authority, we have the authority to declare, you know, certain things, you know, null and void. If we believe the legislation itself is unconstitutional, is an unconstitutional delegation of authority to the governor from the legislature, we have the ability to say that. Generally, we also have the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, meaning that we try to avoid ruling on constitutional issues if we can do so, just because the separation of powers, we have three, in theory, co-equal branches of government, and we're trying to respect that. And we're not trying to superimpose our policy preferences over the legislatures. You know, that's really, the legislature is where the policy discussions are supposed to happen in terms of, you know, and this has been debated in the legislature, will continue to be debated. But sometimes what we say influences how those debates go in the future. And, you know, without getting into any more detail, I will just say that the court's going to carefully consider all the arguments, because there are really interesting arguments on both sides of the issue. And one, at least one amicus party in there as well. And so, Yeah, and we're not the only Supreme Court that's encountered this. The Michigan Supreme Court, I know, had a similar case involving similar circumstances, mm-hmm. and so yeah, state Supreme Courts do get to interpret their own constitutions and state laws, and you know, we try to do as little damage to settled expectations as possible, you know, reliance interests. We're trying to construe the law in a reasonable and understandable way, and not just an academic way. But, you know, we all ultimately have to do justice to what we think, you know, the what the law says.
Right,
you know,
right.
The outcome is another question.
Well, you know, sitting on the other side of, well, you know, in theory at least, sitting on the other side of the pandemic, frankly, I do hope you guys take a long look at the whole thing. And this is an opportunity, I would think, for the entire, all three branches of our government to sort of review the way things went. And I have to believe that we would at least like to tweak some things one way or the other to prepare for another situation like this. So I'm happy to hear that this is before you.
It's interesting, and interestingly, the same day, the 8th of February, I believe, is the day that the United States Supreme Court is going to hear the appeal from the Colorado Supreme Court in the Trump ballot case, where the Colorado Supreme Court, in a 4-3 decision, ruled that Trump had committed an insurrection that violated the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment, and therefore mm-hmm. prohibited him from being on the primary ballot mm-hmm. In Colorado for president. And that opinion has been appealed, as we figured it would be, mm-hmm. to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they have put it on somewhat of an expedited fast track
yep.
briefing schedule. Briefs have been filed. I've been seeing references to them by pundits that have been reading them. And so that argument will be the same day. So we possibly could be overshadowed just a little bit that morning. Frankly, the Supreme Court junkies are going to have some challenges to decide what they're going to listen to.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would expect a relatively fast ruling on that, possibly with opinion to follow, just because of the fact that, you know, the primary season kicks into gear here with Super Tuesday and, mm-hmm. and the first Tuesday of March. And so obviously the New Hampshire primary is tomorrow.
Yep.
There's a lot at stake here. So stay tuned on that. And then finally, before we wrap up here, we talked last month about the Chevron
yes.
case. Well, that was argued last week, actually.
Okay.
two Chevron cases. And the Chevron doctrine was mm-hmm. the Chevron wasn't part of these two. This was the case about the herring fishermen
yep.
that were required to have the monitor on their mm-hmm. boats to watch what they were doing, and the federal agency required the fishermen to pay for it.
Yep.
And the argument was whether who made that decision was
right.
that, you know, was that in the legislation? Arguably not. It was an ambiguous statute. The executive agency enforcing it interpreted it to allow them to require the monitors to pay for the fishermen to pay for the monitors, mm-hmm. I should say. And that case was argued. I think it was like three and a half hours of arguments.
Yeah.
It was a lot. And there's way too much there for us to comment on more today, but I would encourage interested people. There's a number of Supreme Court podcasts out there that go into some detail on what was argued in that in terms of the administrative state
mm-hmm.
and how, you know, when you have a Congress, frankly, that for a variety of reasons isn't writing a lot of laws and certainly not a lot of specific laws, you know, who gets to interpret what those laws mean?
Sure.
Who fills in the gaps?
Sure.
Is it the executive branch or the judiciary?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's very much up in the air right now. So stay tuned for that. That will be a June decision.
Yeah, I would hope so. I would hope that that's not an expedited.
No, I don't think so. There's a lot at stake there. So, but yeah, that's where we're at, Rich. And when we come back in February, we'll be beyond the argument on the Trump ballot case. We'll have our March cases ready to go, and hopefully have some better sense of what the process is going to be for the filling of the two openings.
Never a dull moment with the Supreme Court.
Not
right now.
Nope. We're kind of in the center of attention here. I was really pleased to see the tributes that have flown in on both Justices Chudich and Anderson. Well deserved.
Absolutely.
They've both been really dedicated public servants. We're going to miss them personally a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a family when you are sitting with people making decisions like this.
Mm-hmm.
When the family changes, the dynamics change. You get new members of the family. You got to figure out, kind of what people's predilections are, what they like, don't like. And so, we're looking, looking forward with some apprehension to the changes.
Sure.
But if past is prologue, the court goes on and we have been able to withstand a lot of change. People forget that during the Plenty years, Governor Plenty appointed virtually every member of the court except for Ellen Page. Ellen Page was elected in 1992.
I had forgotten that.
But it's just the happenstance of retirements and appointments. And so, now the Governor Walz and Governor Dayton will have appointed all the members of the court for the foreseeable future. But you know what? The pendulum swings both ways. And the bottom line is our court continues to try to stay within the boundaries, stay true to what our mission is under the Constitution and keep the public's trust and confidence up in our decisions.
Before I let you go, and I understand you're a little pressed for time, so I don't want to get too involved in this, but there's yourself, the other justices that were there that preceded you that are remaining on the bench. There are three others, correct?
Right.
Are any of those people approaching the 70-year old mark?
Well, the closest would be Chief Justice Hudson.
Okay.
She's I think 67.
Okay.
I think she'd be the closest to All it.
Right.
Then after that it would be me, frankly.
Really?
Justices Thiessen and McKeag are both younger than me, which they point out with some, at least McKeag likes to point out with some frequency, but she's no longer the youngest member of the court. Justice Procaccini blows her out of the water with that.
Yeah.
But it would be an order of age on the court. I would be the second most senior, quote unquote, member of the court, not in seniority on the court, but in terms of age. So Hudson and then, me, Thiessen and McKeag in that order.
So barring something strange happening in an election, we can maybe expect after this a little bit of regularity
with
the court.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, I think that's going to be the case. I knock on wood, you know, life happens while you make other plans, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's the reality of the world we live in. But my thought is that we're likely to have a few quieter years on the court. There's going to be some change coming, and there always is. I think you're right. We're not going to have anything like, three members in a year going.
Yeah. Okay.
that's my hope, but my crystal ball doesn't always work.
Wow. All right. Justice Moore, thank you so much. We always do appreciate these conversations. I learn every time you and I sit down, I learn 10 things. So I really appreciate this.
Thanks, Rich. And thanks to the listeners who take the time to listen to us.
Justice Moore will be back again next month. Thank you, by the way, for making some time for my vacation schedule and delaying the show for a week. I appreciate that.
Oh, that was no problem at all, Rich. You deserve that time away, right?
That's a matter of debate. But okay. Anyway, Justice Moore, we'll be back third Monday of February with more Legal Talk. This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.